This is the Oral Talmud, episode 22, Hillel and Shammai, Beyond Elu Ve'elu. Welcome to the Oral Talmud, a co-production of Judaism Unbound and Svara, a traditionally radical yeshiva. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm B'nai Lappi.
The Oral Talmud is our weekly deep dive study partnership in which we try to figure out how voices from the Talmud, voices from 1500 to 2000 years ago, can help us think in new ways about Judaism today. In today's episode, we're back on the daf. That is, we're back to the page of Talmud itself. After a series of interviews about approaches to learning Talmud with Jane Kanarek and Ilana Kershan. And we're picking up right where we left off in episode 19, the Elu Ve'elu episode, to learn more about the dynamics between the schools of Hillel and Shammai. We were curious to look further down that page because people rarely ever read past the critical Elu Ve'elu moment. And as you'll hear, we found what comes after to be a somewhat befuddling example of why we were supposed to like the school of Hillel, potentially undermining the whole message we had landed on. We'll recap what was going on in the text so far, but we always encourage you to do your own chazara, your own review, by listening to episode 19 if it's faded from your memory, or by studying the original text with your chavruta, your study partner. B'nai and I also use this moment to reflect a bit on our conversation with Ilana Kershan from last episode and how we approach being in disagreement and holding strong viewpoints. Every episode of the Oral Talmud has a number of resources to support your learning and to share with your own study partners. If you're using a podcast app to listen, you'll find links to these resources in our show notes. First, to a source sheet on a website called Sepharia, where you can find pretty much any Jewish text in the original and in translation. On each episode's source sheet, we include the core Talmud texts we discuss, we draw out the central questions of each episode, and we share a link to the original unedited video of our learning. In the show notes of your podcast app, you'll also find a link to this episode on the Oral Talmud's website, where we post an edited transcript and where you can make a donation to keep the show going if you feel so moved. On both the Sepharia source sheet and the Oral Talmud website, you'll find extensive footnotes for exploring our many references inside and outside of the Talmud. And now, the Oral Talmud.
So what we're going to do today is we're going back to the page where we left things off 3 weeks ago, because last week we interviewed Ilana Kershan about the Daf Yomi, and the week before, I think we had interviewed Jane Kanarek, also about teaching Talmud in part. And so before that, we were looking at this text from the Tractate Erevin, page 13b. And what that's famous for is this text that we did that time. And so anybody that's interested in that, that's this famous text about Hillel and Shammai, the houses of Hillel and Shammai, the schools of Hillel and Shammai, that is their students, disagreeing. And why was the law, the halakha, the tradition always decided, or almost always in accordance with the views of Hillel? And it gives these three things that the house of Hillel would do. They were humble and they would study both their own opinions and the other opinions, and they would state the other opinions before they stated their own. And we had a whole long conversation about that, which we should repeat today, but just to remind you that that's kind of where we are. And then what ended up happening was that this rest of the page was not on our original, you know, we have a spreadsheet of all the texts that, you know, we're going to definitely do on this show. And every once in a while, we realize there's another one and we add to it. And this stuff wasn't on there. But as I was putting the text up on the Sepharia source sheet, usually what I do is I read a little bit before, a little bit after, just to make sure that I have exactly where the text starts and ends. And as I kind of kept reading, I was like, well, I do have the proper end here where, you know, with those three characteristics or those three behaviors. But then I started reading further. I was like, oh, this is interesting, and this is interesting, and this is interesting. So I sort of dumped them all into the source sheet, and we didn't get to it last time. But as we were looking at it, we were like, oh, let's keep going, because let's see if there are connections to be made here. And I actually think that connects a little bit with this question of how we learn Talmud, and does context matter? You know, are these halachic decision-making sections, how important is it what context that they're in, how close or far they are from other texts?
Yeah, and I have to confess that when you said, let's keep going, I'm like, no, that's not... It's not interesting. Mostly the criterion I use is, have I learned it before? And if I haven't learned it before, it's not interesting. I'm like, ah, no, I don't see anything there. And just like Rabbi Elazar's cow, I said, no, that's not, that's peripheral. It's just a little bit of context. But once I learned it last night on my own, I thought, oh wow, you're right. Dan is right again. There really is something to learning these discrete famous sugyas in context. And yeah, so I'm excited about this section we're learning today, which I just never paid attention to.
I mean, it's so interesting. You know, I can't remember if Ilana said this last week or she said it on the air or off the air, but there was this idea that has also occurred to me in studying Daf Yomi that there's a lot of stuff in the Talmud that, you know, reminds me of in biology and Ilana mentioned this, that of junk DNA. And that's not a very nice word. It's not actually junk. It's not junk in DNA and it's not junk in the Talmud. The point is it's not expressed. It's not part of what generally gets expressed in our bodies on a day-to-day basis. And so it seems like junk. It seems like it's just filler, but sometimes it can become important. There's also the idea of epigenetics, which is the idea that sometimes in certain circumstances, there are genes that we have, but they're not expressed, but maybe due to some kind of trauma, something actually changes and they do become expressed. And then that actually is heritable. And that's where some of the work today in biology is about, like, well, maybe like trauma from the Holocaust really can be expressed biologically, you know, genetically, even though we know that that's not how genetics really works, that you know, there's mutations and those take millennia and millions of years or whatever. But epigenetics is this idea that it's already in our DNA code for some reason, but it can be expressed due to some kind of trauma. And then that expression becomes heritable. So it's interesting that the stories, the pieces of Talmud that, you know, kind of are on your current list, you know, and on our current list, it's like, well, where did those come from? You know, some combination of our teachers and things that we found, and especially you found over the years, and are like, oh, this really connects to Svara's point of view. And then the question is, though, how are texts added to that? And like, how do you do that process of scanning the corpus and saying, wait a second, there's something here that yeah, you know, right?
Okay, another point for Daf Yomi, for
no,
sure.
No, not kind of argument for Daf Yomi, but I will say, and then we should get into the text, because my dad is always telling me that we should get into the text faster. That's his Phoenix Gallery idea of our show. But I will say that one of the things that I've talked about in this whole like Marie Kondo idea of Judaism, that we have to kind of declutter Judaism or else we can't innovate, because if we're just holding and carrying everything from the past, there's no room to innovate. So we have to stop doing things. It's part of the tradition to stop doing things. And it's the only way that we can really, you know, do the work that we've always done to make Judaism relevant for a new time. Then the question becomes, but how do I stop doing things without this tremendous guilt? And I've argued that one of the ways that we do that is this idea of studying for its own sake, that we know that even if we stop doing something, we're going to keep studying it. So that if it comes a time, even 1,000 years later, when that's relevant again, we wouldn't have forgotten it. We wouldn't have been doing it for 1,000 years, but we wouldn't have forgotten it. And I don't know that it's Daf Yomi. It doesn't necessarily have to be a page every day, but some way in which we kind of have that little robot scanning down, you know, just keeping reminding us, wait a second, there's something. And that's like that what we talked about many weeks ago, and it's relevant sadly again with the killing of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, Wisconsin, that protest, you know, that if you don't protest, then the sin is upon you. That was actually a text that when people were discovering it, other people were saying like, this should be one of the most famous texts in the Talmud. Like, why isn't it? Well, maybe it was kind of, you know, hidden under the proteins and now it just got expressed again, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And somebody was studying it. You know, somebody knew about that text, right? If it had been completely forgotten, it wouldn't have been able to be remembered a few months ago.
Yeah.
So
what we push up in prominence in the tradition and what we push down, I think, it is always in our control. And nothing ever totally leaves the tradition. And I think you're right that the rabbis instituted this technology of learning about the things that we no longer want to do in order to assuage our guilt and stay in relationship to them. So we don't have to gunk up our practice with things that no longer work.
So let's look at the text. And I think we're going to spend our time only a little bit of time on this next piece. But I know that you have some things that you wanted to talk about with it. So let me just go to the text here. And what we see is that here is the part that we studied last time about Hillel and Shammai. And right after that comes a little part where they say, and this has to do with one of the disputes of Hillel and Shammai. And it says, as in the Mishnah that we learned, in the case of a person whose head and most of his body were in the sukkah. So it's giving just one of the disputes. That's the context.
Well, let me add one more thing that's okay. important to the context. The important part of the last piece of the Talmud that we were learning 3 weeks ago is the part that said the law is set in accordance with Beit Hillel because they were kind, they were gracious, and they were patient, and they stated the opinion of their opponent, Beit Shammai, before their own. So I think it's this, and they gave precedence in their discussion of their own point to the position of the other guy. And then we get this story, which I think is going to be an illustration of that.
Right. So the case that they're talking about is a case that if you can picture, and if you can't picture it, Renee's going to share an illustration in a second. But it's a case where a person has his head and most of his body in the sukkah, but the table is in the house. And in a case like that, so the sukkah is basically attached to the house, and the table that you're eating on is in the house. You're supposed to sit and eat in the sukkah, and it says to sit in the sukkah. And so you are sitting in the sukkah. Most of your body is in the sukkah, but the table and the food is in the house.
So the question is, if your table is in the house and you're mostly in the sukkah, are you eating in the sukkah? Or since your table is in your house, are you actually not eating in the sukkah and therefore not fulfilling your obligation to eat in the sukkah? As soon as I heard this dispute, I went to my bookshelf and I have this really cool series of, it's a children's book of illustrated Mishnayot. And I went to Mishnah from Sukkah. And sure enough, here's a picture of what the debate here. So here's this guy with his sukkah attached to his house, and his table is inside the house, and he's sitting in the sukkah. Okay, I think the chair is funny because most likely they weren't sitting on chairs. I think the Gemara says they were, you know, leaning on cushions, as they probably all were, not these little Western style chairs. But regardless, that's the dispute. Okay. The question is he actually lay shaving basukas, fulfilling his mitzvah of sitting and eating in the sukkah. All right.
Okay. The house of Shammai, the school of Shammai, deems this sukkah invalid, or this way invalid. If you know, and again, that picture that you showed, it's like I've always pictured this as like a sukkah that's too small to fit your table. And the sukkah that is in that picture is actually quite big. So like, why is that guy not having his table in the sukkah? That's unclear.
The Gemara actually goes into that.
Okay.
So I think that's a question. But at least in this picture, yeah.
Okay.
He could have had his table. Why isn't this table? Probably, I don't know, whatever.
Maybe it was like fixed to the floor. But anyway, okay. So the school of Shammai says that would be invalid, and the school of Hillel would say that it's valid.
Right.
So then the school of Hillel said to the school of Shammai, wasn't there an incident in which the elders of the house of Shammai and the elders of the house of Hillel went to visit a rabbi, Rabbi Yochanan ben Chorani, and they found him sitting with his head and most of his body in the sukkah, that the table is his house. So there's a case where this actually happened.
Yeah.
I think the idea is that they both were there, and they both, you know, nobody, the house of Shammai people didn't freak out and say, like, you're not, this isn't valid. You know, they actually seemed like they accepted it. That's the idea here, right?
Right. So the first understanding seems to be that Beit Hillel saying, hey, y'all didn't say anything then. Well,
yeah.
You actually saw this thing happening. You saw this guy with his head and most of his body in the sukkah and his table in the house. You didn't say anything. So that must have meant we're going to deduce that because you were silent, you thought it was okay what he was doing. You didn't critique him. You didn't say, hey, what are you doing?
Yeah,
so it must be okay. This must be a valid way to sit in your sukkah and fulfill your mitzvah.
Right. And so the house of Shammai said to the house of Hillel people, you're going to prove it from that? From there, do you seek to deduce a proof? Those visitors too said to him, if that was the manner in which you were accustomed to perform the mitzvah, you have never fulfilled the mitzvah of sukkah in all your days. So is it that they're saying that, no, we actually did say something?
Yeah, it seems to be that. You know what this is reminding me of? Do you know this book called Zoom?
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, it's this seemingly children's book, which is a picture book in which you see a fragment of a picture. And then on the next page, you pull out in perspective, and then you see that the fragment was really part of a larger thing, and now you completely re-understand that the fragment wasn't what it was. It's now this other thing. And the next page, you pull out further, and the perspective makes you realize you had misunderstood the picture on the previous page. Now you understand. This is a common move of the Talmud, that it gets you to go, oh, now I understand. And then the very next utterance, it wraps you on the knuckles and says, no, you didn't take everything you had into consideration. Although in this case, it feels a little unfair, as it often does. And it brings you a piece of information which you didn't have before. And the new information here seems to be that Beit Shammai saying, no, we really did say something. And what we said was, hey, if this is the way you think you're fulfilling the mitzvah, you've never fulfilled the mitzvah because this is not valid.
Yeah. And now the part that Steinsaltz adds here, and is this as you understand it, what the point is here, that he says that because in the text it says the house of Hillel people say to the house of Shammai people, wasn't there an incident where the elders of the house of Shammai and the elders of the house of Hillel came and X, Y, and Z happened, that they mentioned Shammai before they mentioned Hillel? So that's a sort of proof that was how they conducted themselves? Is that?
Yes, I think that's precisely the whole point of this story. The sukkah business is incidental. But for me, I don't know. This feels like a pretty weak illustration of, it doesn't feel meaningful to me.
Yeah.
That it reflects anything of my character or way of processing or giving consideration to your opinion by saying, hey, remember that time you and I were da da da? Does that mean anything different than, hey, remember that time that
me and you were?
Right. I'm not buying it.
Well, it feels like it undercuts, in a way, the power of what we were talking about last time, right? Because last time we were talking about, oh, this idea that you mention the teachings of the other person before you mention your own. It's like, you know, we were taking it, and when I would teach law school, you know, I would take it. I would say, like, look, yeah, that's good lawyering. You make the best case for the person that you're against, and then you show why, you know, you understand their best case, and nevertheless, you think that they're wrong. You know, it's not that you just say, hey, you know, you're a hypocrite because you came with me to the, you know, like, that's not the point there. But if that's the example that the Talmud brings to follow it right up, the question is, therefore, either is that actually the point, meaning we were putting too much onto it before, or another possibility is that Hillel and Shammai, like the original story, that there are two pieces here. There's the original teaching, which is that this is what the house of Hillel would do, and they would state the opinion of Shammai before stating their own. That is the really, really deep teaching that we talked about last time. But then a later interpretation of that, which is illustrated by the story here, almost undercut the whole thing by saying, like, it's just as simple as saying the person's name before saying yours. And they just, meaning that whoever wrote this next paragraph kind of misunderstood the original teaching. That's kind of what I want to think.
Yeah, or we know that one of the moves of the Talmud is typically to bring a piece of Agadata, some sort of narrative, to problematize, destabilize, refine, challenge a previously stated law. Now, this is not exactly in that pattern, because we don't have, this is really a piece of narrative on top of a piece of narrative. But there was the statement that the halacha follows Beit Hillel. It's sort of a pseudo-halachic text, maybe. So I'm wondering, is this story possibly a challenge to, or a kind of a wink, somehow saying, no, they didn't do that. No, it wasn't important. I don't quite know, but how could this be undermining? I mean, maybe that's what you were saying.
No, what I was saying was that it was misunderstanding. That you're saying that it's undermining, I think, is really interesting. You know, that it's kind of saying, like, actually, Hillel wasn't that humble.
Yeah.
You know, like, you know, actually, you know, or like, actually, this is a teaching, but that's not really the reason, you know, because at the end of the day, Hillel wasn't all that humble either. Or something.
It's, you know, something. I don't know. I'm really not sure. But it sure seems like a very impoverished virtue. In this story, it seems so minimal as to make me then insert, if I insert this understanding, like, this is really what it looked like to share the other guy's opinion before you are. And it's like, yeah, like you said, maybe that's not really what was important in the story. I'm not sure.
But I think what's interesting about it, though, is that given, and, you know, it actually connects in an interesting way to the story that we studied, the Oven of Achnai, that famous story, that often also is also only the first part of it is read. And that first part basically says mm-hmm. that we can ignore a voice of God under certain circumstances, you know. And but the second part of the story is that it didn't turn out so well in the end, you know, and maybe nevertheless that point holds that we don't have to listen to God's voice anymore and that we have the power. But actually, it's not as simple as that. We actually have to not just dismiss the person who is our, you know, contrary. And by the way, like, think about that story in relation to this text, how we read it last time about Hillel and Shammai. It's like, what if Rabbi Joshua had been nicer to Rabbi Eliezer and said, I want to state your opinion. You think that the voice of God came and told us that we should do this, but, you know, the reason why we're not is, et cetera, and I'm not going to excommunicate you. I'm going to honor you or, you know, whatever. And then maybe Rabbi Eliezer wouldn't have been so hurt and caused such destruction, et cetera. But that story is often taught without the destruction part. And here, this part is often taught without this illustration that potentially undercuts some of the more radical places where you could take the first one. And I'm not sure what to do with it. Like, in the same way that the Oven of Achnai story, right, misquotes the Torah, right, and takes the part that they like and say, you know, it says follow the majority, even though it says don't follow the majority, you know, but it does say follow the majority. It just says no, follow the majority. So they just erased the no, and they did quote it accurately. Just it's like dot, 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 follow the majority. Here, if you only quote that first part of the Hillel and Shammai text, it's still an accurate quote of the Talmud. And if we can actually understand it to be more powerful than maybe even the redactor of the Talmud understood it to be at that time, then I don't think that's actually doing violence to the text. I think that's saying, well, that's the way that we do choose and bring forward parts of the text at different times. And maybe in our time, that's the part of the DNA that's going to be really expressed. And that other part that was kind of this illustration, this example that a little bit undercuts the radical potential of what's being taught. Okay, so we're going to not express that at this point in time.
I have to say, my brain and my heart are still so occupied with our discussion with Ilana Kershan last week, specifically our post-recording conversation. So I hope I'm not being overly TMI here. But I was so like chomping at the bit to get into that conversation with somebody about Daf Yomi, because I'm such a Daf Yomi, what's the word? I'm a curmudgeon about Daf Yomi. I'm not a fan at all of Daf Yomi. And I was just so excited to like have it out, and your reflection back to me, I took as really gentle tochucha, you know, compassionate critique. You say you didn't mean it that way, but what you said to me was, I'm not sure you were all that Hillel like. And I've been thinking about that all week because it felt really true. And it was like, yeah, wow. Isn't that funny that we were learning about Hillel and I love that text and here I am not embodying it? And that was one of the questions that I brought to the conversation with Ilana, is like, that's my secret fear, my deepest, darkest fear, is that learning Talmud doesn't actually make us better people. And that learning that story about Hillel obviously didn't make me more Hillel-like. And I'm kind of disappointed to hear that with this story about the sukkah, and this is an illustration, like, I actually want to be held to a higher standard. I want to be more like the Hillel of the way we understood the story 3 weeks ago, and not like this Hillel. Like, I was this Hillel, but that wasn't much.
Right.
I really want the bar to be higher.
You know, like, when you and I studied Daf Yomi last week, it wasn't very good. You know,
Yeah, it's like, really, was it enough for me to say to Ilana, okay, you and I both love Talmud. Am I being Hillel-like because I said you before I don't know.
Let's read on in the text, because I wonder whether the next part of the text actually shines some light on this, in the sense that the next part of the text, I would argue, kind of undercuts the part of the text that we just read, which means that it strengthens the original interpretation from a couple weeks ago. So let's explore that.
Okay.
Okay, so the next part it says, this is to teach you that anyone who humbles himself, the Holy Blessed One exalts him. And anyone who exalts himself, the Holy Blessed One humbles him. Anyone who seeks greatness, greatness flees from him. And anyone who flees from greatness, greatness seeks him. We can read the next one too, just to, but I think it's a little bit different, but, and also important. So maybe we'll want to make a distinction. But the next one, it says, and anyone who tries to force the moment.
Yeah.
The moment forces him. And I think it helpfully says, and he doesn't succeed. I mean, if you try to force something, it won't happen. And anyone who's patient and yields to the moment stands by his side, meaning the moment, gives in, right?
Yeah.
So the way that I at least that the first part that said, and that now we're in the realm of aphorisms, but I think that it's an aphorism connected to behaviors, right? Because there are a few behaviors that were described. The more generic behavior, you should always teach the side of your opponent before you teach your own. And then this particular story about being in a sukkah and how, at least arguably, Shammai talked, you know, the Heskel Shammai, if you've done it this way, you've never even been in a sukkah, you know, like that's not very nice. And so it says, you know, so then the aphorism in a way, the way that says, well, and this is the message that you should be getting from this, is that if you act humbly.
As illustrated by citing your opponent's position first.
Yes.
Or naming their name first.
And I would say that naming their name first is not very humble.
Yeah.
So I would say like that if I want to read this aphorism now and say, anyone who humbles himself, the Holy Blessed One exalts him. And anyone who exalts himself, the Holy Blessed One humbles him. Then I would say, like, you got to be really humble. I mean, I don't think that that's just, you know, I said, didn't you and I do this last week instead of saying, didn't I and you do this? You know, like, that doesn't seem, I mean, if that, it just doesn't feel like that's a level of humility that merits that the Holy Blessed One would exalt you. So part of me feels like, in a way, this part undercuts that very minor humility that we might see in the previous part where Hillel just mentions that, hey, Shammai, didn't you and I go to see Rabbi?
Yeah.
So, you know, and same like anyone who seeks greatness, greatness flees from him. And anyone who flees from greatness, greatness seeks him. That feels like it's got to be a more significant fleeing from greatness than simply mentioning your name first.
I know I'm being a little trippy and associative, but this thing about like if you're forcing something, again, it reminds me a little bit of like how I was chomping at the bit to prove that my opinion of Dafyomi really is, and it also reminded me of this story that I had read in a book about the Yeshiva Volozhin. So I'm just like wild about the Yeshiva Volozhin. It was a yeshiva that is like the beginning of modern yeshivot. And it lived for about a century from about 1806 or so to 1890 something. And it was started by a student of the Vilna Gaon, Reb Chaim of Volozhin. And I remember this story and I went back to the book and I had actually turned down the ear of the page. Mm-hmm. And it's a story of Reb Chaim going to his teacher, the Vilna Gaon, and saying, I really, really want to start this yeshiva. And he's so enthusiastic about how he wants to do it. And it's sort of this Zen story where the Vilna Gaon just sits and listens and says nothing and doesn't give him his approval. And he's frustrated. He doesn't know why. And years pass. And finally, he goes back to his teacher, the Vilna Gaon, and in a very sort of calm manner explains why he wants to make this yeshiva. And his teacher finally says, yes, now go make it. And he says to him, why now are you giving me approval before when I was so like excited? He said, you know what? You were too excited. I want to read the quote. He says, when you first presented your idea, the Gaon explained, you were so enthusiastic that I feared that somewhere deep down lay some trace of personal interest, which would in due course lead to failure. Now that you have waited so long and have made your case calmly and with detachment, I see that your purpose is solely for the sake of heaven. Not only is your proposal itself a desirable one, but it is also motivated by the purest intentions. Therefore, your efforts will meet with success. So it kind of reminded me of this point that if you're like too much trying to push something, that may reflect some subconscious self-interest that you haven't teased out.
Yeah. No, you know, and Binay, like, this is probably going to make you a little bit uncomfortable, but I want to say that it's also true of me and some select number of people that we know who are out there working in the Jewish community today, particularly in this kind of innovation sector of trying to create new things. Some people have spent a lot of years in the vineyards before anything really happens. And, you know, a lot of like in the funding world, there's kind of this idea that, you know, you should get something funded quickly. And as soon as something's working, it should be scaled up. And that's kind of such a strong force out in the Jewish community today that it almost feels like hard to resist it. And I feel like, you know, I've known you, you know, as everybody thinks today about like Svara, that it's like such a big thing and so successful. And, you know, and I just feel like I remember those years when Svara was basically you. And, you know, and I would even be like, what are you, why are you calling it Svara? Like, it's just you. Like, it's, well, why do we have to give it a name? You know, like, and you're like, no, like, I, this is something bigger. This is, you know, and there are so many times when you could have given up and probably should have for all kinds of rational reasons. And I actually think that this is hard when you start to think about funding, because I actually think there's some real merit in whoever kind of sticks with something for a decade where they're not making money, they're losing money. You know, they're not, it's not like they're beating down the doors and they're selling and it's just failing. It's just like, they're just trying to go and go about their business and do their thing. And eventually they get discovered, you know, and it's like the classic overnight success that's been working for a whole career, you know? And like, I really feel like that's in a way the story of Svara, like what you just said about the person who founded the Yeshiva in Volozhin. You know, it's that, you know, you had a vision that I think was very analogous to what's going on probably 20 years ago, but you know, you didn't force the moment and now it's happening, you know? So I don't know, but I mean, it feels like this is, as we talk about this, it's really registering for me.
And you know what, thank you. And what you're bringing up for me is a critique that I'm hearing from Black folk saying, stop the urgency. The sense of urgency, white folk, is actually not a good thing. And that seems counterintuitive, right? It seems like, oh, now I'm wakey. I realize now this thing that I should have realized before, what's happening in our world, and I want to fix it. And what I hear them saying is, you know what? This sense of urgency is really, it's wrong. You really need to slow down. You need to do some learning and relationship building and all sorts of things. And then the work you do may be more meaningful. But don't push the moment. Feels a little bit like that critique of urgency.
Yeah, you know, it also makes me think about in Stephen Covey, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People, one of the habits, I can't remember what the name of the habit is, but one of his catchphrases about that habit is, with people, slow is fast and fast is slow. Mm-hmm. You know, and what he means by that is that the fastest you can get somebody to move is actually very slow. And it's pretty much exactly this point. It's saying, and if you try to force them, if you try to push hard, it'll actually make it all slower because they'll get defensive, they'll get confused, they'll, you know, et cetera. But it gets to this question of like when you were saying about the Alana conversation is like, and did I implement it? It's like, if it's an aphorism, if it's just an aphorism, it's like nothing, you know, an aphorism is nothing. Like a stitch in time saves nine. It's nothing. I don't know how to translate that into practice. And that's why I think in Hamlet, the character, the father of the friend, now I'm blanking on his name, who just unloads this whole like bunch of aphorisms to his son, who's going off to like college, I think. And he just like dumps these aphorisms on him. It's actually a comic moment in Hamlet because it's just silly, because aphorisms on their own aren't anything. And if you're really trying to share wisdom with a child or with another person, it's about how do you conduct yourself? How do you actually implement this aphorism in the real world? And that's hard to just like unload on somebody the night before they're going off to college. Like that comes from a lifetime of modeling it and stories about how others did it and all of that. And I feel like on this page, what I'm trying, and again, maybe I'm trying to like force something that's not there. And that would, of course, be an obvious violation of the principle itself. But what I think I'm trying to see on this page is a combination of aphorisms, and in that Hillel and Shammai, I might have reordered the page. I might have put the aphorism first, but maybe that's actually not a good pedagogical technique. But I feel like Hillel would state the opinions of Shammai before stating his own. Like that feels to me very practical wisdom. Like you always, if you get into the habit of always conducting yourself this way in every conversation that you have, then eventually you'll be able to do it in the hardest of conversations. If you don't practice it in the easy conversations because you don't need to, then when you get to the hard conversation, you're not going to do it because you're not going to, you know, be in the habit. And I mean, that's where, like, I think that a lot of times, like, I think we see this a lot, like when I was younger, I think you heard this a lot in like the active listening space where people would, you know, people had learned that what you should say is, so what I hear you saying is, you know, and then they would, and it got to so much that you were like, this is driving me crazy. But actually it's not a bad technique because it is silly and not necessary like 90% of the time, but it makes sure that in the times when it would help that you're used to doing it. And now I think people, I hear there are other language that I hear among like millennials and Gen Z folks, for example, that also kind of ring a little rough on my ears because it's not types of language that I learned to use, like centering yourself or there's various like phrases like that. But that actually, you know, when you look at it and you say, oh yeah, if I always was conscious of this, then when I'm in a situation where it might really be a problem, I'm going to do it right. Or, you know, and so, like, that's kind of what I see going on in this page. It's trying to do that, trying to help you not just make this an aphorism, but I'm not sure it's doing it well.
Okay. So you know what you're bringing up for me? I had a teacher once named Eliezer Slomovic, and he was just an extraordinary human being. And he was a survivor of the Holocaust. And he was one of those people who, he was just so gentle and so kind. And when you would sit in his office and talk to him, he would look at you the way they talk about gurus who look at their students and the students feel completely and totally seen. And just that experience of being in their presence transforms you. When I knew Eliezer, I understood that. That's what it felt like. It wasn't like he was mouthing, oh, what I hear you saying. When he would hear you or look at you, you felt completely and absolutely seen, heard, understood much more deeply than whatever it was you were, you know, making visible about yourself. And that comes up for me because when you talk about the habit of saying what I hear, you know, obviously that only is meaningful if there is a really deep listening underneath it, and it isn't just a performative thing. I don't know.
But I think I agree with you, and I want to, like, I'm thinking about the way that one becomes this man, Professor
Eliezer.
Because, first of all, it's possible that he was like that from childhood, and there are people that are basically saints, and that, to me, that's not who the Talmud is for, you know, meaning it's wonderful when you read something and you're like, oh, I am that way. You know, actually, I wonder if you then run into the, like, you should flee from greatness thing. Cause like, if you think that you see yourself in something, you probably have to practice a little more humility, even if it's really humble.
Yeah. He would never have thought what he was doing was anything.
Right.
Yeah.
But let's say that you're not born that way. Let's say that you're actually born like most of us with an ego. And with bad habits that you might have learned from childhood, from sibling rivalries, you know, whatever taught you bad habits. Mm-hmm. So how do you become the person who truly listens in a saintly way? I think it may actually start with this, so what I hear you saying, business, even when it's not really sincere. And I think that there's this question, and it definitely comes up in different Jewish conversations about, like, should you practice, you know, it's a little bit like the Nasev and Ishma, you know, should you practice before you've internalized the reason for the practice, or is it okay to just do the practice for itself? And because that if you do the practice and make it a habit, eventually it penetrates to your heart. And eventually you actually become a person who loves to listen as opposed to a person who learned that you should say that I'm listening. And I want to be open to that avenue, because I think that ultimately I want a world in which people can change. Like, I want a world in which people are not born how they are, which might come to the next text here, by the way, which I hadn't seen before. But
I agree with you, although at this moment I'm feeling that it's not that behavior. It's not the performance that gets you there. It's some, I don't know, maybe that performance can get you to the light bulb moment of, oh my goodness,
that's what
I don't own the whole truth. Right. And then that's what
I'm trying to say.
That
I think that it's very grating when people are saying those performative things. Maybe even this, I mean, maybe that's a way to understand this part that, you know, where Hillel said, Hey, Shama, you and I both went to the MS and how he gets credit for that. But maybe that's that early stage performative.
I like that.
That was the younger Hillel did that. Or, you know, the school of Hillel. It's the school of Hillel. So that's Hillel's students. But actually Hillel, I mean, he really humbled himself, you know, whatever, right? But I do think it grates on me no end when people just use those phrases. And I know that they're not really listening. And yet I think that the more humble, wiser part of me says, but if they're really doing that religiously, I think it does get you to that, or, you know, it can get you to a point where you really are sincere. And then, by the way, then you don't have to say it anymore, right? Then, you know, I don't think that people who are actually listening have to say, so what I hear you saying is, you know, they based on what they said, you understand that they knew what you were saying.
Yeah. Okay. Here's what's coming up for me now. Being so like in the thick of really looking at myself after our conversation with Ilana. On the one hand, I'm looking at this text this week. And when I learned it, I thought, oh my God, if I had learned this text before the conversation with Ilana, maybe I would have approached that conversation differently and not been like, oh, okay, I can't wait to make my point. I can't wait to like show that she's wrong and I'm right. And I feel a little embarrassed about that. And now I'm wondering, would I actually have been different after learning this text? Would I have recognized myself in it before I had actually fallen into the hole and you had pointed that out to me? Probably not. I probably would not have seen myself in this text had I not already recognized something wrong. But now seeing the text, I'm like, yeah, that's what I was doing. I was trying to push. I was trying to make myself look right. And I don't know. What are you going to say?
That's why I think something like what you could call tochacha, which is some kind of rebuke or calling out, calling in, you know, that you could say that actually is a really valuable piece in all this, if done right, if done lovingly and by a loving friend, right? Because that experience of having messed it up, and I'm not saying you did in this case, but I'm just saying, you know, hypothetically, the opinion that the experience of messing it up is actually a critical part of the learning process of then being able to see yourself in this text in the future time. And again, certain saints don't need that maybe, but most of us do. And there are times when I've, you know, messed something up, you know, a different thing or whatever. I don't want to get into the story that I have in my mind right now because it actually puts me in a very bad light. But it doesn't because I learned from it. But I don't know that if I hadn't messed up in that particular case that I would have really learned as deeply an important lesson that actually, I'm to think about something from college. So we're talking about like 30 years now that I've had that lesson and I've been a better person for it, a much better person. And maybe I would have only learned that 15 years ago. And then I would have hurt a lot of people over the course of 15 years. So, so I feel like there's something about that, you know, at the end of the day, right? I want the Talmud, I want Judaism to be a tool through which we become better people. And I think what we're trying to, and I appreciate that you've really kind of put a frame on a lot of the texts that we've studied over this last kind of period about this is where the Talmud is in different ways articulating the ideal kind of person that it aspires to beyond just the ideal kind of Talmud learner. It's like, this is the ideal kind of human being, even when it's framed in terms of Talmud learning or Torah learning. And I want that to be what the Talmud is about. And I hope that it is, but I do see that in here, it's like, yeah, you know, like there's the philosophy, the aphorism, there's the implementation in the rule book. Okay, here's how you would implement it. But ultimately, the only way that you actually take it into your soul is through trying to implement it in your actual life. And often that's going to be failure. And when it's failure, either you'll learn because the failure is apparent, and maybe that's this, you know, pushing forward the moment, right? And it just fails, and you learn that way. And maybe it's because a loving friend told you that you didn't do what you aspire to do, or something.
Yeah. Okay. Now here's what's coming up for me now: this question of, do aphorisms really work? So when I was hearing you tell that your own story, I thought of an aphorism elsewhere in the Talmud where it says the place where someone who has transgressed and done tshuva stands, a tzaddik gamor, a completely righteous person, can never stand at that level meaning you become a better person actually through messing up and going through that process of tshuva than if you never messed up in the first place. And what's coming up for me is that reading that aphorism, what it does is it gives me language to feel better about myself or to have a framework for what I just went through that says, yeah, that's a good thing. Don't feel ashamed of what you did. That's actually a good thing. And the tradition sees that as the path toward growth. And now I have language for it. And I have a perspective on it because of that aphorism. It's not that the aphorism was motivating. It's that it now frames what my life experience has made. I don't know. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Okay, let's go to the next part of the text because in a way, like all of a sudden I'm seeing it in a new way because of this conversation, which by the way, like we both study this separately. You know, we only get it through the conversation. So that's part of Talmud study, the whole idea of chavruta. And chavruta, by the way, the idea of it often gets translated as your study partner, but it comes from the root of chaver, friend. I mean, like it really, and I think what we're talking here is like, it's really the friendship that allows certain things to come out in many cases.
And if you, by the way, if you dig even further into the root of friend, it really means to connect or to tie.
Right. Yeah. Right. And you talk about how when the Talmud talks about, gives different names for God. So sometimes it's the Holy Blessed One. Sometimes it's the one who created the earth, spoke and created the earth, whatever. And there's these different, and you say like, you got to pay attention to that because when it uses this way of God's name, it probably is trying to position itself in a certain way and connect it to the other times when it uses that way of calling God. And so a very simple level reading that you could give of the two stories that are here in this text about cases where Hillel and Shammai disagreed or the houses of Hillel and Shammai disagreed, you could say like, oh, those are just two cases that they picked. Or you could say, No, they picked those cases because they fit into this conversation that we're having here. And they were on what we're talking about. Like they actually, this is not us making this up. This is part of the structure here. I'm still a little lost with the sukkah, but.
Oh, okay. But maybe the thing about the sukkah is what you brought it out before, which is maybe the part of the sukkah story that's relevant here is what we have Beit Shammai saying, which is, this is how you did your sukkah observing. You never really did. I mean, that's kind of mean. Maybe the attention really is like the goal was to draw your attention to that part of the story. I don't know.
That's why like I love what we're doing here because we're learning. We got to make up a new word. It's like learning teaching. It's not like we don't have the answers. We don't even, you know, but and sometimes we have stronger opinions than others or pre-existing. And sometimes that's bad, you know, because then we don't do the Hillel thing. But anyway, like, so anyone out there that has a take on this, we'd love to hear it on that good part. Okay, so let's finish the text because I think this other part is fascinating. Like, why is this? First of all, the whole thing is fascinating. Second of all, it's like, why is this here? Okay, so they just taught the Braita, which, right, so a Braita is something that kind of comes from the time of the Mishnah, but isn't actually in the Mishnah. For 2.5 years, the house of Hillel and the house of Shammai and the house of Hillel disagreed. So they have, you know, this is a long-term disagreement. One side says, ostensibly Shammai, it would have been preferable had man or had human beings not been created than to have been created. And the others say, those said, it is preferable for man to have been created than to not have been created. So one side says it would be better if we were never born at all. And the other side says it'd be better. It's better that we were born.
Okay, let's just stop here for a minute.
Yeah.
This is a very depressing, I don't know, this feels like the kind of feeling, like the kind of question that comes up for you when you feel, God forbid, suicidal. Yeah. It really is something that comes out of a deep sense of depression. Like, gosh, it would have been better had I never been born. And not only, it would have been better had none of us ever been born. It feels like it's coming from a place of real despair. So I'm kind of wondering what is going on there?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, okay. I remember when I first heard about this text, I remember my dad, I mean, I it's like, actually, like, you're right. It's like one of these things that's sort of so shocking is like the Binding of Isaac and this. It's like some of these stories that you hear and you're like, it sticks with you forever. Because I remember as a kid, my dad somehow told me this story. And I just remember as a kid, I'm like, what kind of a question is this? You know, like, but it stuck. I've never forgotten it. And by the way, I know it's one of these amazing things where then you kind of stumble across it in its context and you see, oh, here's where it's from. And this is where it was. So maybe, why is it here? But yeah, no, I'm totally with you.
Right? Okay.
I mean, by the way, this is a time, School of Hillel, School of Shammai is a time more or less around the destruction of the Second Temple. So it's not a good time. I mean, it's a pretty bad time to be a Jew.
Yeah.
In some ways, it was a good time because they created a new kind of Judaism, but it was a pretty depressing time to be a Jew. Okay.
And we don't know who said which is interesting. I'm going to guess Beit Hillel said, yeah, it's better that we were created. And Beit Shammai saying, no, it's actually, it would have been better had people never have been created at all. Okay.
Which makes the next part a little interesting, because if it was Shammai who actually said it's better to be not created at all, then says they were counted and a conclusion was reached.
I just want to note on this translation, they were counted. There's a lot of dispute about what that means, counted, because the verb is very weird in Hebrew, but it probably means they voted.
Yeah.
Typically that expression, nimne uvagamru, it's like they took a vote. They were going to decide the answer to this question by a majority rule. Okay. Which is interesting.
Which is a little interesting for two reasons. Like, one is that because we learned that the law is always according to Hillel, so this isn't exactly a law, but it wasn't decided according to Hillel necessarily, like in that way.
Right.
And number two, that 2.5 years and then they voted. It's like, what, you know, right? Like, was there like a filibuster? Like, why did, why didn't they vote after like 6 months? You know, like, it just seems like a long period of time. Anyway, right. Okay, so they voted, and it was concluded that it would have been preferable had man not been created. It'd be better if human beings had never been created. But now that they have been created, people should examine their actions, and some say he should scrutinize his actions. So, I mean, Steinsaltz is interpreting that as the one case they say you should look at your past actions and correct them, and others say that it's more about looking at what you're planning to do in the future and making sure that you do the right thing. But either way, the point, we can talk about the differences, but either way, the point is that it would be better to not have been created at all. But since we're created, we should sort of make the best of it.
Make the best of it and at least try to be as good as you can be. It's like, It's like we're never going to be as good as would make it worth it to be even on the earth. Again, sticky on that. It's hard to wrap my head around that.
Yeah.
But okay, as long as we're here, one opinion says at least do tshuva, examine your past actions to be better. And the other opinion, and I think this is really fascinating to think about these different approaches to what's the best way to get to be a better person, by looking at what I did before. Or in the second opinion says, no, forget what you did before. Just focus on right now and what's in front of you. Focus on what you have the opportunity to do and examine whether the action that you have the opportunity to do is the right thing to do, whether it's a transgression or a mitzvah. The thing you can do, is that what you should be doing? That's where you should be investing your time, not, you know, what did I do last year? And I think as we're in Elul now, coming on the high holidays and this process of spiritual introspection, these are very different approaches. And I'm fascinated by shifting from what is the typical way of looking at how to be a better person from, oh, what did I do last year? Who do I need to, what did I do wrong? To, okay, how do I make better decisions moving forward?
And maybe it's obvious, but the way that I am thinking that this connects to what we've been talking about is that it's basically saying, look, there's this better way to be, the Hillel way, humble, stating the other opinions before your own, examining, studying both your own views and your opponent's views. But we're not born that way. That's a very hard, mature place to get to. And part of it is you could say, yeah, it would be better if I didn't even have to go through this, you know, better not to be born at all, or better to, if I could just live the nihilistic life that I would live, you know, it's just like, why do I have to do this? Is hard. This makes life hard, but there's a way. Meaning like, but if you're not that way by birth, you're not the saint, you got to work at it. That's the work of life. You know, there's something, I mean, we don't have enough time now, and I don't know if we have enough time in a lifetime to fully get at this, but I actually think it's like a really, there's something really here that is connected to the whole thing. And it's kind of fundamentally saying, like, it's not like the School of Hillel people were better human beings than the School of Shammai people. It's like they worked on it and they got there, something like that. And that sort of feels like a connection with this last part to the first part.
Yeah, I like that. Here's what I can say about this text. My mother is a puzzle maker. doesn't make puzzles. She puts puzzles together. She loves puzzles. And she makes these puzzles that are called gold box puzzles. Have you ever heard of them?
No.
They come from this company in England. They're wooden puzzles, and they come in a box without a picture on the cover. And I feel like with this text, we have a gold box puzzle, and we've just dumped the pieces on the table. And we haven't even found the corners yet. That's how I feel with, that's where I'm at with this text. So I just want to say to everybody listening and to you, I feel like we haven't even begun to put the picture of this text together, but it's exciting and the pieces are on the table.
Yeah. So what I would say to you is, like, I'm looking forward to our next conversation, probably not on the air about this, because I think there's a lot for us to chew on here, you know, and kind of, yeah, like something feels to me like there's something really important here that we should kind of keep digging at. And I'd love for folks that are watching and listening to do that too. And maybe this is one that we can have an ongoing dialogue with folks that are learning and learning together. And I also just want to say that for me, there is one piece where I kind of feel like we found a corner, you know, like for me, it feels like there's something deep in here about the hard work of being the person that I want to be and that the tradition wants me to be. And that the idea that it's not easy and that it can't be, it can't be learned through aphorisms, and it can't be learned through, like, just doing the halacha, you know, just doing behaviors without allowing yourself to truly be shaped and reshaped and to be conscious of that and open to rebuke and open to change. Like, that there's something here where it's, and that's where, like, to the extent that this is a bit of an end to that bunch of texts where we're really looking at the ideal kind of person that the Talmud's trying to create. Like, I do think there's this temptation to look at these great people, Rabbi Meir, genius, you know, Simchus could, you know, have 150 different, you know, ways, right? And it's like, but I'm not that genius, you know? So, so I think it's better to say, that no, this is the worst. So that's kind of where I'm holding.
I like that. And the shift from, don't think it's about being right. Don't think it's about what you know. Don't think it's about even being successful or effective at getting your agenda out there. That also ultimately doesn't necessarily make you a better person, and keep your eye on the fact that's the goal. Okay, maybe we have a corner.
All right. I'm happy to leave it at a corner. So next week we will we'll on to a new topic, and we're excited to explore that. So hope we'll see you all next week.
Great. Thank you, Dan.
Bye, Vinny.
Bye.
Thanks so much for being part of our Chavruta today. We hope you've enjoyed learning with us and with the Talmud. You can find links to the source sheets for all of our episodes in the show notes and on our website at oraltalmud.com. Your financial support helps keep the Oral Talmud going. You can find a link on our website to make a contribution. We'd also love to hear from you. Email us with any questions, comments, or thoughts at hello@oraltalmud.com. Please share your Oral Talmud with us. We're so excited to learn from you. The Oral Talmud is a joint project of Svara, a traditionally radical yeshiva, and Judaism Unbound, two organizations that are dedicated to making Jewish texts and ideas more accessible for everyone. We're especially grateful to Sepharia for an incredible platform that makes the Talmud available to everyone. It's free at sepharia.org. And we're grateful to Svaranik Ezra Furman for composing and performing the Oral Talmud's musical theme. The Oral Talmud is produced by Joey Taylor with help from Olivia Dvorah Tucker and with financial support from Lippman Kamfer Foundation for Living Torah. Thanks so much for listening. And with that, this has been the Oral Talmud. See you next time.